Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's Medical Podcast. I'm Dr. Mike Todorovic. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Matt Barton. How are you, Matty?
Hello.
And today we are doing an episode on spinal cord injury. Now, spinal cord injury, we've done an episode on the spinal cord itself, and now we're going to talk about what can happen when the spinal cord itself is damaged. We are joined by a special guest today, and our special guest is a regular of
Dr. It's more a regular guest than special. I mean, I guess
special regular guest.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's nothing.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, there's nothing regular about Dinesh. I mean, he's a medical doctor. He's a lawyer.
He's a
sea captain.
Last time we had him on, which was months ago,
He
had just gotten Order of Australia medal.
Yeah, Order of Australia.
So now a lawyer.
Yeah, I don't know where you find the time to do all this stuff.
I do it while I sail.
While you sail your 50-foot vessel.
Yeah, being a sea captain's a lonely life.
It would be, yeah, plenty of time for study.
Exactly.
So Dinesh is going to join us. He's going to be able to help us here because as a physician, he'll be able to tell us exactly what happens, at least in the acute phases of spinal cord injury. But Dinesh himself has experienced a spinal cord injury and he'll be able to give us personal insight as well. And I think that this is invaluable because we'll be able to compare what it says in the textbooks that we learn, but also the lived experience of a spinal cord injury and see if it matches up. And I think it's going to be a really, really good and important conversation to be had. Dinesh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me again. And thanks for covering this really important topic that's close to my heart.
Perfect. You're always welcome on. If you know, to be honest, I would replace you with Matt if I could.
But I agree.
Matt's it's stuck in like glue. Unfortunately, we signed a contract with Matt and he's got another
Well, Dinesh is a lawyer now, so he can probably break it. Yeah.
Well, after this, let's have a look at the contract.
So to begin with, I think what we should do is probably define a spinal cord injury. And so Matt and I spoke about the spinal cord in the last episode. And what we said that the spinal cord itself is a highway. It's an interface between the brain and the body. And it's the brain's way to tell the body what to do. And it's the body's way of sending signals to the brain about what's happening outside and inside the body itself. Now, when we look at damage to the spinal cord, so we said that the spinal cord begins after the brain stem, so after the medulla, moves its way down to around about L2, and then it turns into something called the chorda equina, which is a splaying of nerves coming from the spinal cord. And anytime there's damage to that spinal cord, it's going to result in some degree of loss of functional mobility or feeling. And so what we're going to talk about are different types of spinal cord injury, what happens immediately after spinal cord injury, but also the long-term effects of spinal cord injury. So, Matt, I'm going to throw over to you. When we look at spinal cord injury itself, you can damage any aspect of the spinal cord from the cervical area all the way down to whereabouts.
Well, as you said, the spinal cord really ends at the lower regions of L1. So, I mean, anywhere along that can be potentially damaged. And then depending on the severity of the injury, whether it's a complete injury, so the whole transectional area is damaged, or part, so like a hemisection, or possibly a central portion or a peripheral portion would determine kind of what neurons are affected. So these are the things going up and down, but also in and out. So that would depend a lot of variables. And I would imagine, and Dinesh might be able to add something here, but every spinal cord injury would be different. So it's not an exact, always the same. So even if it's at a certain level, because it could be partial, complete, centrally involved, peripherally involved, it could be quite different. Is that right, Dinesh?
Exactly. You got to remember that these are often traumatic injuries. They're often not clean insults that you get to the cord. So the variety of the nature of injuries is vastly variable. The other interesting thing actually is that a majority of injuries are not anatomically complete. So there's often a little bit of cord left, more often than not. So therefore, you're going to get quite a variation in what people feel and what people have left or what people don't.
So that's in reference to like the clinical grading. So from a clinical standpoint, they might be scored in a certain way. And we'll talk about this shortly. But they might be informed by the physician that they got this kind of degree of injury. But in fact, if you were to look at it anatomically, it would be different. Is that what you're suggesting?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So in terms of the levels, I'll just quickly run through them. So the highest level of spinal cord is the cervical region, and so this would you would expect that the more severe end of injuries would be in this area, because it's the kind of top of the highway or the top of the elevator. So everything below that's going to be affected, and this is usually going to result in conditions known as either tetraplegia or quadriplegia. Now, with the first kind of few levels, so we got C1 down to C8. They're the levels of the spinal cord that would allow spinal nerves to go out into the body. The first few, particularly 2, 3, 4, 5, has an impact on the breathing muscle. So very high spinal cord injuries, probably anything above 3, is going to cause a big impact to the breathing muscle, the diaphragm, and then that may result in the person requiring ventilation or assistance with their breathing. Now, as you move down the cervical and you come towards the thoracic, this is the area where the nerves are going out or in and out to your arms. And so I would imagine different levels here would impact the arms differently. So an injury kind of like C5, you might have, you know, shoulder movements, but then the lower hand would be affected and so forth. But I guess as you start to move towards T1, then you'd have a greater sensation and movement in the upper limb. So Dinesh, question to you, in terms of your particular injury, where is that located, and were you told what kind of severity of injury you have?
Yeah, so I have a C6/C7 injury. And that's where the C6 and C7 vertebra became dislocated because my neck hyperflexed during a car accident.
Okay.
So neck swung forward, and the force was enough to make these two vertebra dislocate on top of each other and thus damage the spinal cord at that level.
Okay.
My injury is, as you said, it affects parts of my arms. So I have the use of my biceps. I have the use of my shoulders. I have the use of my wrists, although wrist flexion is a little bit weak. And I can use my triceps, but they're, again, weak as well. I have no use of my fingers at all. And below the level of the injury, I have some sensation, but it's not perfect anywhere. And this actually an interesting, I guess, side note about Brown Séquard type injury. So Brown Séquard,
like a hemisection.
Exactly. So mine's not exactly a hemisection, but I have more sensation on one side than the other. So there's a bit more sensory function left on one side than the other. And that is useful to highlight Brown Séquard syndrome as a side note, because physiologically it's quite an interesting type of injury where you get a hemisection of the spinal cord, which is not what I have, but some people can get this hemisection.
Okay.
And that results in paralysis of the sides that's hemisected. And then you get sensory deficits on the contralateral side of the body, so the other side of the body. And this kind of anatomically ties in where one side of my body has some nerve fibers left on the cord, and then the contralateral side has more sensory function. So that's...
And what about the distribution of pain and temperature?
I don't have enough. I'm not able to differentiate sensory function enough to say any of those things. I can just, if I put enough pressure on certain parts of my legs or my belly, I can feel that something's there. But I can never differentiate what it is. Interestingly, though, I did put a hot towel on my legs recently because I was at work and I was carrying, it was a hot blanket to a patient. And I could feel temperature on my thighs, which was, which I just happened to accidentally notice.
Yeah.
So that's
And do you think that's – so the fact that you hadn't necessarily experienced that prior but experienced that during that particular experience, what do you think that was indicating? Is it indicating the fact that there's some, high threshold – receptors there that, given enough time and enough temperature, they'll pick up that thermal input? So what do you think that is?
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. And I guess the blanket was wide enough. It covered a large enough surface area to do it. Now, having said that, I was also carrying a pizza on my lap recently. And I got a pretty decent burn on my knee as a result.
Oh, no. So you didn't feel that was happening?
I started getting a bit of autonomic dysreflexia, which is when I noticed. So I know we'll cover that later.
Yeah.
More just sweating. More just sweating.
So okay. I think an important point here to highlight is when we look at Brown Séquard, for example, if you look at the textbook definition of Brown Séquard, which obviously is rarely the case when you have a perfect hemisection, meaning just one side of the spinal cord's damaged. Usually you're going to have some degree of spinal cord that remains, or partial areas of both sides of the spinal cord are going to be affected. But if we just look at the textbook definition of Brown Séquard, like you were stating, if one side of the spinal cord is damaged because of the anatomy and physiology of sensory signals, we know that fine touch and proprioception travel up the spine the same side that it enters. So if there's a hemisection on the right side at, let's say, the thoracic area, that would mean that sensation of the right leg, for example, wouldn't be felt because it's getting impeded by the hemisection on the right-hand side above it. But pain and temperature, they like to jump across to the spinal cord as soon as they enter and then travel up the spine. And therefore, the pain and temperature on the right leg, for example, may be preserved because it's jumping the other side, bypassing that hemisection. When we look at the motor neuron crosses at the brainstem, so at the medulla. And so you're going to have issues with movement of that leg on the same side as the hemisection below. So that does that? Would you agree with that, Dinesh?
I do concur.
Cool. Thank you.
Michael.
Thank you, learned doctor.
So just before we move on to the next topic, just to complete the levels of injury. So then we go into the thoracic region. And this region's more concerned about the muscles of the trunk, sensation of the trunk and abdomen. Now, Dinesh, you mentioned that your injury is around C6, C5, C6. Mm. So theoretically, you're not going to have an impact in your diaphragm, your breathing muscle. But the thoracic level will have a function in breathing to move the ribs and for greater respiration beyond the passively from the diaphragm. So from your standpoint, what kind of impact have you had from a breathing standpoint?
Yeah, this is one of the really significant issues. For me, when I first had the accident, I couldn't talk a full sentence like I am talking now. It was a few words, take a breath, a few words, take a breath. And
is that,
I was dependent. Sorry.
Is that because a lot of your talking is dictated by your diaphragm now? Like you're relying on your diaphragm to really to dictate the amount of air that can come out to speak?
Yeah, it's, I think, just over time and training, and I guess we're always talking every single day, so it's not really a difficult thing to train, which it just naturally happens over time. So over time, I think the remnant respiratory musculature has adapted so I could talk like this.
Okay.
I also use a trunk support brace every day, and that increases the intrathoracic pressure by increasing the intra-abdominal pressure. So it does a bunch of things for me.
Yep.
It not only helps me breathe better, but it maintains my blood pressure as well and posture. So respiratory function was a big thing, and I was dependent on supplementary oxygen for a period of time. And intermittently, I still get breathless sometimes. So I still get breathless, and sometimes I can noticeably feel that I'm breathless when I'm at work. So it takes a minute to settle.
So the accessory muscles not getting innervated, like the intercostals, for example.
Exactly.
Gotcha. So it's all diaphragmatic breathing. So you rely on the diaphragm for the breath in, and you rely on pressure changes and rebound, like a elastic recall, for the breath out.
Yeah, and I've done a formal respiratory function test previously, and we know that it's quite poor. And there may be some thoracic muscles left that help me breathe, but a lot of it is paralyzed. Right. And there's a whole host of complications associated with that, actually, apart from your physiological respiratory function being compromised, which may or may not affect your day-to-day function. So, for example, a high-level spinal cord injury will be ventilator-dependent because everything will be like it. So apart from that, you get sleep apnea as well because your respiratory function is so poor. When you sleep, the same thing happens, particularly because there's no muscles supporting what you're doing, and you can get just this
neurogenic, okay. Opposed to an obstructive apnea.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be a mix of things.
Yeah.
It's going to be a mix of multifactorial thing that causes it.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, people with spinal cord injuries are very prone to sleep apnea. So I recently had a sleep study done maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and we were finding that I was having apneas up to 75 seconds at night, and I was desaturating to, you know, well below 85% for periods of time. And I was having about, on average, 4 to 6 awakenings per night. So no wonder I wasn't too surprised that I was feeling so tired.
Yeah, absolutely.
All the time.
So you being treated for that with a CPAP or a bipap?
CPAP, yeah. I use a CPAP now, but I rip it off during the night. And another strategy is to sleep upright, which kind of takes the pressure off.
Okay.
The thoracic cage as well.
So when you've got that apnea for what 70 odd seconds at a time, and your O2 sats drop, what does your body reflexively do to bring that up? Because obviously, if somebody has some sort of apneic event, accessory muscles will get recruited to try and bring more air in and throw that carbon dioxide out. So do you then start to just do very sharp, shallow breaths, very quick, sharp, shallow breaths? How does your body get back to that, you know, 99% saturation?
Well, this is why you have awakenings, right? So you have frequent, that's why those awakenings are recorded. Mm. And sometimes I will actually wake up consciously,
right.
And I will be short of breath, and it'll take me a period of time to get back to sleep.
Right. So you get to shift from that unconscious to conscious control of breathing just to get it back.
Yeah, and people have these micro awakenings through the night where they where they will wake up because of those apneas.
Yeah. Just one final question before we move on to the lower levels. What about like just coughing or sneezing?
Again, terrible. So the expiratory function is affected, and therefore the cough is terrible. So for me to cough, say I get the flu, or if I get a cold, or if I get whatever, I have to assist myself to cough, or someone has to assist me to cough. And this was particularly prominent in the acute stages.
Okay.
You get respiratory physiotherapy often, and a part of their job was to, just do chest physiotherapy to
clear
remove
things.
The secretions. And yeah, exactly. So sometimes when I get a, the flu, I make sure that I get vaccinated every year. But if I get the flu, I will have to press my belly to cough. And it can be exhausting because you're using your arms to try and push and push and push every time you cough.
Yeah.
Or you have to get someone else to do it. So it's a serious thing. Now, this is why we are concerned at the moment about people with spinal cord injury and COVID-19.
Mm.
Because even in the larger population, we're seeing a mortality rate at the moment of about 2 to 3% is what I've seen over the numbers. But, what will happen if someone is unable to cough and you already have a poor set of respiratory parameters?
Yeah.
What will happen to them? So that's one of the concerns.
The difficulties in breathing and the shortness of breath is happening for people who have full control of, accessory muscles and diaphragm and everything like that. So does that mean that, generally speaking, the spinal cord injured community are at an increased risk of developing things like pneumonia if they've got a reduced capacity to clear those airways? Does it increase the likelihood for infection to start to develop in the particularly bacterial infection?
Like
to
pneumonias.
Like the pneumonias?
Yeah. Yeah, because the cough is a part of a defense mechanism too, right? It helps us expel things. It helps us clear things. So when that's impaired and your respiratory function's impaired, yeah, absolutely. People with spinal cord injury are at increased risk of respiratory complications, which is why caregivers should be a bit more vigilant about getting the proper vaccines in place,
yes.
Making sure that there's proper hygiene measures, and if anyone around them is sick, to be a bit more careful. And again, I think the current pandemic has put that on our radars a bit more because there's a social change towards social distancing and wearing PPE and whatever else.
So as a physician, as an emergency physician, how do you then mitigate your risk? Because you're getting people coming in who are sick but don't probably know what they... I mean, you've got people coming in from motor vehicle accidents and you know, other forms of traumatic accidents, but somebody coming in ill with potentially a transmittable disease, how do you minimize your exposure? Is that just through PPE or what do you do there?
Yeah. Oh, should probably clarify resident in the emergency department as well.
Sure.
This is actually a thing that we have thought about, and currently I don't see any of the respiratory patients because we're just not sure, right? You can't be 100% sure that someone has COVID. In Queensland, right now, it's unlikely, but I just try to avoid any patients like that. And there are plenty of doctors around that do that. If there are other patients, I take the usual precautions like hand hygiene. If a mask is required, I wear it. So it's taking those precautions. It's super important. But yeah, large majority of patients coming in are not with respiratory symptoms at the moment. But if they are, then I'm careful. I'm even careful with things like people who come in with gastroenteritis, for example.
Yeah.
You can imagine that would be a tricky thing to navigate.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, I'll just quickly finish off the last bit of this. So we've got the thoracic injuries, which kind of started to talk about. Another big area in the thoracic region is the sympathetic nervous system. That goes from T1 to L2. So injuries in the thoracic region can...
It's okay, everybody. We're just calling Dinesh back.
Oh, dear God.
That's okay. You hung up on us, awesome, didn't you?
We might I don't think so. It just...
That's okay. We might even leave this in.
Where did you cut off at?
You were just done until about T1 to...
Yeah, so with the thoracic injury levels at the thoracic region, we've got another important section being the sympathetic nervous system, which goes from T1 to L2. So this is an area of your autonomic nervous system that does the kind of fight and flight. So injuries to the thoracic region can impact this autonomic system. Now, we will talk about autonomic dysreflexia a bit later. So just for time, I'll move on to the lumbar region.
You don't want to talk about now?
Why
not? And then we'll move through. Might as well.
All right.
I think we should. So
if there's an injury, particularly above T6, there is a possibility of a syndrome, if that's the correct term for it, which impacts the way that the sympathetic nervous system is regulated. So, Mike, you've done a couple of videos on this, so I'll hand it over to you to explain the pathophysiology of this.
Sure. So, and Dinesh, please jump in at any point, but I think it'll be great to get your both your medical experience and your personal experience regarding autonomic dysreflexia. So, basically, with autonomic dysreflexia, when we look at the sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight system, we know that it exits the spinal cord at the thoracic or the lumbar region, and it innervates or speaks to a number of different organ structures, and it will tell them to do certain functions in a scenario of fight or flight. So anytime your body thinks it's at risk of danger, it will stimulate this system. So types of things that can happen with the sympathetic nervous system is your pupils dilate, your peripheral blood vessels will constrict, this increases your blood pressure, your heart rate goes up. A whole number of effects happen to try and keep you alive in that moment because it's to promote fighting or run away to fight another day. Now, if somebody has a spinal cord injury at T6 or above, what can happen is that this level of injury is right where the sympathetic nervous system is sitting. And something can stimulate, some sensory stimuli, such as an obstruction in the bladder or bowel, for example, can stimulate sensory neurons. And this is going to go into the spinal cord and try and travel to the brain because it wants to tell the brain, hey, there's something...
Usually noxious, right?
That's right. There's something noxious. There's something that needs to be done about this. But as it travels up, it gets impeded by the spinal cord injury. So this is not usually... This isn't something that's necessarily happening immediately after injury, but something that can happen long-term after injury. Now, as it travels up, it gets blocked at the level of injury. But when it does this, it ends up stimulating sympathetic neurons that are in the spinal cord. And you have this sympathetic outflow coming from the spine and you get sympathetic effects. Now,
so all these sympathetic effects are below the injury.
These sympathetic effects are happening below the level of injury at the moment. And one of the things that happens is the blood vessels constrict. So you've got the peripheral blood vessels, they constrict, and what it does is it increases your blood pressure. Now, the blood pressure didn't want to increase. There was no reason for it to increase. So the brain recognizes that there's an increase in blood pressure because your carotid arteries have baroreceptors. And so it goes to the brain and says, hey, blood pressure's up for some reason, we need to drop it. So it goes, okay, I'll send an inhibitory signal going down. And what it does is it sends this inhibitory signal and a vagal nerve signal, which is the flip side of the autonomic system, which is the parasympathetic nervous system. And the vagus nerve goes to the heart and it says, hey, slow down. So if you slow the heart down, you're going to drop the blood pressure. And so that's what it does. And so two important signs here is an increase in blood pressure, but a drop in the heart rate, which is recognized as bradycardia. Now, the thing is this, the sympathetic nervous system that's being pumped out is trying to get dampened by a descending inhibitory signal, but it's getting stopped at the level of the spinal cord injury. So what you end up getting is below the level of the injury, a sympathetic effect, and above the level of injury, a parasympathetic effect. And so some parasympathetic effects you can get above the level of injury, apart from slowing down of the heart, is the blood vessels of the face can dilate. And so you have this flushing effect of the face. But now you've got blood vessels dilating above and blood vessels constricting below, and this can result in a headache. And so a headache can be a common symptom as well. Also, nasal congestion due to the dilation of these blood vessels in the head as well. And so these are some of the more common signs. Now, the sympathetic nervous system usually controls sweating, but the parasympathetic nervous system can control sweating if the sympathetic nervous system is out of action. And so above the level of injury, you can get the parasympathetic nervous system stimulating a sweating response. So the take-home message from what I understand with autonomic dysreflexia is you get a bump up in blood pressure, you get a drop in heart rate. Now, you don't always, but this is probably most common, a drop in heart rate. Flushing, headache, and sweating is some of the common symptoms indicating that autonomic dysreflexia is occurring. And it's usually stimulated, like Matt said, by some sort of noxious event. Usually, it's some sort of issue with the bladder or some obstruction in the bowel. Now, Dinesh, I want your experience as a medico and as somebody with a spinal cord injury to tell me, what have I said that's correct, incorrect, relevant, irrelevant? I want your perspective.
No, that is a very good that's really good. I guess the thing to remember is that autonomic dysreflexia is a life-threatening complication.
Yeah.
And it is critical that you manage it promptly. People can get strokes. And when I was in the hospital after the spinal cord injury, one of the other patients did have a stroke in his sleep from autonomic dysreflexia and sadly passed away.
Now, do we know why the stroke?
Is it hemorrhagic?
Yeah, exactly. Because your blood pressure can go up to, we're talking... Hugely, you can go to 200, 300.
Whoa.
These sort of numbers have been recorded.
And that's just simply because it's uncontrolled.
It's uncontrolled. Because normally your brain would have some descending inhibition that dampens these signals. Mm. So it's uncontrolled and it is critical. This is a life-threatening thing that you call the ambulance about if it's happening and you can't correct it. Most people with spinal cord injuries know their symptoms, know what causes it, and them and their caregivers can manage this pretty quick to figure out what's going on. And like you said, a common thing is the bladder, or it can be skin, or it can be, it's usually a quick thing.
So you said the there pizza burn was the stimulus for yours recently, burn, right?
The pizza burn, exactly. The other thing is autonomic dysreflexia, again, is a continuum. So you can get very, very mild symptoms from a tiny noxious stimulus.
Yeah.
Some Paralympic athletes use it to enhance their performance because you cause yourself a tiny bit of pain and
sympathetic drive.
You suddenly have a exactly.
Wow.
And you might see I often
it's performance enhancing for them.
It's performance enhancing.
Wow.
But
will they need to control it after the event? Like, because I assume that doing the exercise isn't sufficient to then mitigate it.
Well, you see, if I I don't pinch it, but I sometimes just push my knuckle into my thigh for a second and my blood pressure goes up. So I sometimes do that all the time.
So
hypotension happens, right?
Ah.
I often feel a little bit off because the blood pressure is low, and then I just bring it up by wiggling my leg a bit or just causing a tiny bit of pain. And it only lasts a second. It comes back. It's very rapid. So
what makes it, sorry to interrupt, but so obviously you said it can be life-threatening and it can be uncontrolled. So is there a threshold point, for example, where it becomes uncontrolled? So you said, you can push your knuckles into your leg, cause a bit of pain, and you cause a transient increase in blood pressure, but you said it gets mitigated.
Gone.
Okay, but the pain's gone and therefore the pain was the stimulus for the sympathetic nervous system. So what you're saying is that if there's an ongoing noxious event, that's what can lead to autonomic dysreflexia getting at it. So this could be as simple as an inflammatory response due to an infection, for example?
It could be anything. Like we said, the most common causes are, bladder, skin, that sort of stuff. But there are times where you can't find what the noxious stimulus is. And those can be things like fractures, which people are very prone to because in spinal cord injury, you're often osteoporotic or osteopenic. There can be something intra-abdominal happening, like appendicitis or cholecystitis or something like that. It can be even things like a pulmonary embolism or a pneumonia if you can't feel that. So if you can't find an obvious cause, you go fishing for those things because you've got to remember that a person with spinal cord injury may not be able to tell that they've got abdominal pain. They may not be able to tell that they've got a fracture.
Yeah.
They may not be able to tell all these things. So you've got to go fishing if you can't. So the first things that you do is remove any tight-fitting clothing, have a look at the skin, make sure that, if there's a catheter in place, make sure that it's not kinked, whatever else. You look for all the obvious causes. Mm. If you can't find the obvious causes, you need to start fishing for one of those more occult causes. Okay. I had this period recently, probably about 10 months ago now. And this is an interesting bit of physiology as well. We were talking about how you sweat and you get all these autonomic symptoms above the level of the injury.
Yep.
What happens to me, and I haven't really grasped the physiology of why, is that if I have an insult on one side, I start to sweat on the contralateral side. Like if it's a mild to moderate insult. And it's actually really useful to me because sometimes I'll be sweating perfectly on one half of my face, say it's the left, and I know that there'll be an insult on the right.
And do you think that's because of? Do you think that's because you're stimulating? It's a noxious stimuli, and so the pain pathway that's ascending up the spine is ascending on the opposing side, on the contralateral side, and that's leading to some afference that's hitting some some sympathetic or parasympathetic efference as it's traveling up the spine on that opposing side, maybe?
Maybe.
That's interesting. Hard.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's hard to tell because you do have a spinal cord injury, right? Maybe there are some maybe there are some fibers remaining that can cause that. Because if you have an injury that's fairly, you know, anatomically complete, and there's no ascending signal, it's probably hard for the body to lateralize it, right?
So, absolutely.
Well, isn't there a condition, I think it's called Horner syndrome, where in the face, I think this is due to the ganglia, one of the sympathetic ganglia in the cervical region, that causes one side of your face to become sweaty lack of one of the two, I forget. But I wonder if that is got a kind of a role in it as well, sympathetic, the way that the sympathetic is impacted.
Well, this was so when this was happening to me, like I'd be soaked, right? I think I can't remember which side, but one side of my body. So the shirt was soaked; it was wet, and my face was wet, but the other side was perfectly dry. And this kept happening for weeks without us finding an obvious reason for it. So we looked at the skin, we looked at everything, nothing. And then in the end, I was at work and I was talking to one of my bosses and they're like, okay, we need to do something about this because, you know, you look ill and you are soaked on one side. So we did a CT scan and we found on the contralateral side, there was a little lesion that we had to drain.
Wow.
And as soon as we drained it, I felt perfect.
Wow.
So
you only found it by doing a full body CT.
Yeah, because we had no idea where it was, and we'd looked at all the obvious stuff. We'd done all the basic investigations. Still happening. So, you know, it's not ideal because CT scans have a bit of radiation, but with this ongoing, you had to figure out what it was.
And so, would you say that that event is autonomic dysreflexia? Was your blood pressure up, for example?
Yeah, it was minimally up. Yep. But the interesting thing was it was, symptoms on just one side of the body.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I have had very severe autonomic dysreflexia from a bladder complication.
Yep.
I was overseas at the time, and a lot of there is a lack of awareness in a lot of places about how to manage autonomic dysreflexia. And I ended up in this emergency department in a rural, not rural, but a developing nation.
Oh.
And my blood pressure was about 240 systolic.
Whoa.
And my heart rate was about 30.
Jeez.
Wow.
And I felt...
Were you conscious?
I was soaked in blood. I was conscious, but because I guess you still got perfusion, right?
Yeah.
But I was so, so sick. And we really had to fight to get them to understand what was happening.
Wow.
So it is a thing. And a lot of people try to carry a card around on how to manage autonomic dysreflexia and what it might be.
So in that case, let's put your physician hat on for this point. If you have blood pressure at that amount and you can't really identify what's the root cause, what's your go-to kind of management/medication?
Yeah. So the most people have something at home, and the two most commonly prescribed things is GTN or nifedipine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's prescribed to people to keep at home with instructions that if they are feeling symptoms of autonomic dysreflexia, generally take this and call the ambulance.
So these two just dilate the blood vessels, right?
Yeah. I think I guess the one thing that some need to be aware of is that if they're taking things like sildenafil, which is Viagra, and they should not be using GTN during that time because that can be quite a severe hypotensive event.
Yeah.
So they've got to be careful with that. But those two are the two things that are generally used. And then call the ambulance if you can't, you know, fix the cause. Most of the time people will know that it's the bladder or whatever else, but if you can't fix it, take the medication, call the ambulance.
And so would you say that
when
Yeah.
When people turn up in the ED, you can go through a lot of the basic stuff, like, again, checking how the bladder's doing, do a bladder scan, is there a big volume in there? Have they been having any other symptoms that that could help you figure out what's going on? Has there been any recent trauma, falls out of the wheelchair? Have they had any fevers or whatever? And then you essentially got to fish around for a trip. While you're doing that, you do need to keep the blood pressure in check. So you need to bring the blood pressure down. And
if you bring the blood pressure down, will that fix the heart rate?
Yeah, it should usually respond.
Yeah.
The thing you got to remember is you bring the blood pressure down, but you need to you really need to keep in mind that the moment, as in within seconds of you removing the stimulus, that blood pressure is going to normalize.
Wow. Yeah. So then you can have a hypotensive event.
Exactly.
Oh.
And I've seen this and experienced it myself.
Wow.
So you need to make sure that whatever you're using, you're very careful and you're able to withdraw it quickly. Another strategy that I've had on myself is to have a second line in the other arm with a bag of fluids ready to go.
Oh, just a bit, really? To bring your volume up.
Yeah, to bring the volume up, which is not going to fix it super quick, but it can help.
Yeah, wow.
Another thing I've seen somewhere is this has happened and then they've gone to vasopressors to bring it up and they've just had this up and down fluctuate blood pressure that couldn't get under control with the patient ending up in the ICU for a period of time. So it's something that you need to be careful with and be mindful of.
So difficult sounds difficult to manage then, because obviously getting the right, because you'd want to, like you said, blood pressure goes up, goes through the roof. You want to treat that. So you give something like, you said, nifedipine or GTN, blood vessels dilate, relax, blood pressure goes down. Oh, I've identified what the issue is. It's the catheter. You fix the catheter up. Oh, blood pressure goes all the way down. You then have to give them vasopressors or something else. That then brings it back up, maybe a little bit too high, and you're playing this balancing game back and forth with pharmacological agents and interventions, maybe fluids, maybe drugs, and you just do this until there's a balancing point. Or how do you manage that?
You don't get to that point, because if you're mindful and judicious with what you're doing, then you can be careful enough where it doesn't get to that point.
Yeah,
I think you just have to remember that if as soon as you remove that stimulus, the blood pressure is going to normalize nearly immediately.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I said, for example, by causing myself a little bit of a noxious stimulus, I can manipulate my blood pressure.
Yeah.
So,
this is what got you through med school. Oh, I'm sorry, law school.
This is exactly.
So as a side question, again, with your physician hat on, what about a female with a spinal cord injury at that level and she is pregnant? So if she was to give birth, that would be a visceral, noxious experience. Would she have to kind of pre-medicate for the likelihood of autonomic dysreflexia?
Yeah, you can even do things like epidural anesthesia. Like a regional epidural anesthesia or whatever, and that seems to control these things.
Stops the sensory going up.
Mm.
Yeah, okay.
So you can do things like that as well, and that can help. So if you can't identify this or if you do know like where the nociceptive cause is, you could use, I guess one example might be a childbirth or appendicitis until you take the appendix out, yeah, or whatever. You could pretend, you could use like epidural anesthesia or something, right, to do it. Yeah, but you just got to be careful that you're aware that the blood pressure is going to drop.
Yeah,
right. When you, yeah.
All right. Well, moving on to the lumbar region. So now this is the lower back. So this is, there's five nerves here. So the greatest impact and an injury at this level would be the lower limbs. So again, depending on the level of the lumbar would dictate the muscles and the part of the lower limb that's affected. Now, in terms of the sacral region, this is all about, significantly about pelvic viscera, so bowel, bladder, sexual function. So an impact here will have an effect on the bladder. And we spoke about that. So an effect being neurogenic bladder. And that kind of goes through stages from, and this would probably run parallel to spinal shock, where you may lose all neurological function to the bladder, which I presume you would just have urinary retention. Is that right?
Yes, I think so. I'd have to double check that.
And that itself, by having retention causing the bladder to kind of expand, would be a form of noxious stimulus. So that in itself actually then be a reason for the autonomic dysreflexia.
Yep. Yeah, like I said, a blocked catheter or a bladder insert can certainly, like a calculus can be other thing.
Oh yeah.
So those things can certainly cause autonomic dysreflexia.
All right, so that's the levels of the spinal cord, and that's the different things that can happen along the way. In terms of the injury itself, Mike's just going to quickly talk about what actually happens immediately at the site and then a secondary effect.
Yeah, so I want to talk about, because for the listeners who may or may not be aware, Matt and I and also Dinesh actually do research into spinal cord injury. And there's a number of different research projects that are being undertaken all around the world to try to manage the damage that's occurred at the spinal cord injury, circumvent further damage, and mitigate any sensory or motor function loss, for example. But there's also other types of research that's occurring utilizing machinery, robotics, all those types of things. So in order to understand how these research interventions proposed to work, what we need to do is talk about what happens at the spinal cord immediately after injury. And so I think what you've got is the primary and secondary phases of injury, and the primary injury itself is basically the direct damage that occurs, and most commonly it's some sort of damage that's happened to the bony material. Fragments, shards come off, and that can lead to ongoing pressure on the spinal cord and direct physical damage to the spinal cord itself. Now, this is that primary injury. The secondary injury, now the primary injury is immediate. The secondary injury will happen seconds, minutes, months, weeks, years after. And it has a barrage of cascading events that occur. So after the spinal cord is directly damaged through, let's just say, bony fragments, for example, you can have damage to the blood vessels that are there. Now, the real large blood vessels of the spinal cord, like the anterior and posterior arteries, they're rarely damaged, but the smaller blood vessels that branch off to feed the spinal cord, they can get damaged and they can be torn, and that can lead to bleeding at the spinal cord and pressure on the spinal cord, which leads to further damage at the spinal cord. But what it also means is that there is a loss of oxygen and nutrients to the cells in the spinal cord. And the cells that we're talking about are neurons, which send the signals, and glia, which support the neurons, help them send the signals. So this loss of oxygen and nutrients means that there's no energy being produced by these cells. And this is important because a lack of energy results in a whole cascading a range of events. So for example, for a neuron to work, it needs to take sodium that sits outside the cell and throw it inside the cell. Now a neuron can send a signal. Once that's happened, we need to throw the sodium back out of the cell. And to do that, we need energy. Now, there's no energy in this scenario, so the sodium remains inside the cell. We need to find another way of getting that sodium out. Luckily, we've got a bunch of calcium that sits outside the cell, and we just swap it. So we throw the calcium in and we throw the sodium out. In doing so, we accumulate a whole bunch of calcium inside of our cells, our neurons of the spinal cord, and we get this huge calcium influx. Now, the problem here is that calcium influx stimulates cells to die. And so these cells then die and burst and they release their components. And what they release are neurotransmitters, among many other things like inflammatory chemicals. But let's talk about the neurotransmitters like glutamate first. So glutamate spills into the tissue surrounding the neurons at the spinal cord. And glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter. So all the neurons that are working well at the spinal cord at this point get stimulated by glutamate. Now, what happens here is glutamate stimulates healthy neurons by throwing calcium into those neurons and sodium, just any ion with a positive charge to it. Now, because there's so much glutamate, we throw in too much calcium and it results in more cell death. And this is called excitotoxicity, something that we don't want to occur. Now, current research is looking at ways to avoid these types of things by blocking glutamate channels called NMDA inhibitors or antagonists, by stopping the sodium and calcium going back and forth. There's research doing that, for example. And what's happening is that the inflammatory chemicals that are being released stimulates an inflammatory response. Now, inflammation is good in the short term because it leads to rebuilding and repair, but it's not good in the long term because if it stays too long, it can result in further damage. Anytime you have damage to tissues with a blood supply, inflammation occurs and rebuilding is stimulated. Now, it's great to rebuild because a spinal cord injury is going to damage the blood spinal cord barrier. And we need a good blood spinal cord barrier because it stops any infectious agents or any toxins or drugs that shouldn't cross from the blood into the spinal cord and protects it. Spinal cord injury damages this, we need to fix it. So inflammation promotes repair and we repair it. But inflammation is non-specific. So it's like tearing a house down and rebuilding the house. The problem is you're now rebuilding a house on a highway, the spinal cord. And so you just build a wall up and this is a scar that forms. And this scar is known as a glial scar because it's the glia that actually promote this inflammatory process. So what we end up having over weeks and months and years is this inflammatory response that leads to a scar being formed, and this scar leads to inhibition of any neurons and glia from being able to communicate with one another. So in spinal cord injury, we need to allow for repair to occur, but we need to stop this scar from building. So this is the type of stuff that we're doing. I know that took a little bit, so I do apologize, both Matt and Dinesh, but I think it's important to build that picture because then it allows us to talk about research, for example. Now, this is just some tissue changes that occur, but what I want to move on and talk about, unless Matt and Dinesh had something to add, is I want to talk about motor movement, because I've spoken a bit about sensory and Brown Saccard, for example, and I want to talk a bit about motor movement and reflexes, if we can. When we look at motor movement, you've got two neurons coming from the brain going to the muscle that needs to move. So if it's conscious movement, it's going from the motor cortex. It sends a signal down a motor neuron that crosses over at the brainstem at the medulla, goes to the other side, continues down the opposing side of the spinal cord. This is still one neuron. This is called the upper motor neuron. And then at the level in which it wants to exit, let's say for the leg, so it's going to be the lumbar sacral region, it's going to synapse with the second motor neuron called a lower motor neuron, and that goes out to tell the leg to move by telling the muscles to contract. So upper motor neuron, lower motor neuron. In a spinal cord injury, you can damage either an upper or a lower motor neuron, and what we get are varying effects because the lower motor neurons involved in reflexes. And so I've said before in a podcast that the lower motor neuron seems to always be stimulated and the upper motor neuron plays an important role in modulating it, sort of inhibiting it a little bit. And so when you have a reflex, let's just say a patella tendon reflex where you stretch the tendon of the patella with a little hammer, it sends a sensory signal into the spinal cord. That then talks to a lower motor neuron, which sends a signal out to tell the leg to contract. If you've got an upper motor neuron injury, it's not mitigating or inhibiting that lower motor neuron. So you get an excessive motor response, an excessive reflex that happens. But if you have damage to the lower motor neuron, you're going to have an absent reflex, for example. And I think this is something that we should probably talk about And maybe you can help us here, Dinesh. When it comes to reflexes, and either you can talk about what you've seen medically or what you've experienced personally, how do you see the reflexes happening depending on the level of the spinal cord injury?
Yeah, so your reflexes are going to be hyperreflexic.
Yep.
If you have a spinal cord lesion generally, or like always. So if, because normally you get signals coming down from the brain, like you said, it inhibits the reflex. But in spinal cord injury, that is absent. So you're going to get a hyperreflexic state. Whatever reflex you test below the level of the injury is going to be a hyperreflexive one.
Yeah.
You also get these other reflexes like the Babinski reflex, where you look at the movement of the toe, whether it's up or down. So with this one, what you do is you stimulate the bottom of the foot in a certain way. And if you have a upper motor neuron lesion, your toe will go up. And if it's normal, the toe will go down, the large toe. So you get reflexes like that you can look at as well. These are the mechanisms around spasticity as well. So spasticity is a huge thing for me. Not normally in my day-to-day life, but when I'm laying in bed, I guess the stretch of the certain tendons cause spasticity, particularly at my hips and lower limbs. These would be the same mechanisms because there's no descending control of it.
Yeah. Interesting. So,
and the same thing would happen with, particularly with the bladder, because the bladder is a muscle, just like you said, and it's got a reflex associated with it. And if you knock off the higher descending inhibitor, the bladder can be also hyperreflexive, which means it's over tense, and then that can cause incontinence. So because the bladder is a muscle, so it's contracting more than it potentially should, and it's, instead of squeezing a bone like a skeletal muscle, it's squeezing the urine, and that can cause leakage. And particularly over time, the bladder can be kind of so hypertrophied, which means its muscles become too kind of big, that the bladder becomes kind of too muscly for its own good, if that makes sense, which then causes a problem that if the urine in the bladder is too highly pressurized, it can push urine back up to the kidney, which can cause forms of renal failure. And I think this was one of the common reasons why people with spinal cord injury historically died, is because of probably kidney failure or kidney infections. And so probably those kind of reflex to the viscera is going to cause complications as well.
So yeah, and you can't show a muscly bladder off to the chicks.
So. So would you say that for yourself, for example, that because of the level of spinal cord injury, that if you were to perform a tendon reflex of your arms, for example, that is there an absent reflex there, but if you did it for your legs, it's hyperreflexive?
Yeah, they're maybe an area where it's absent. We've never really had that detailed a look.
Yeah.
But generally, anywhere below the injury is hyperreflexic.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the level of injury, because you've likely damaged the lower motor neuron, is the absent reflex. Okay.
That probably has some implications for recovery down the track as well. When we come up with these therapies and treatments, one of the questions that's floating around is what happens to the motor function at the level of the injury? Have you damaged the lower motor neurons irreparably? What's their state? I think those are some of the questions that are still unclear.
Well, they're very important because obviously the lower motor neuron, if intact, will release growth signals. And these growth signals include neurotransmitters, but also other chemicals to the muscle tissue itself. And so if the lower motor neuron is intact, you're going to get a less diminishment in the size of the muscle itself. If the lower motor neuron is not intact and is damaged, then those growth factors aren't getting released, and you're going to get muscle size loss that is more significant if the lower motor neuron is lost compared to those that have lower motor neurons intact. And so, you know, you can obviously, it just shows that, you know, if you have a hyperreflexive response, the lower motor neuron is intact and therefore the muscle can be stimulated. The issue is it's a circuitry issue, like in electronics. It's just one part of the circuit is damaged. And so that's why I think a lot of the robotics-based interventions are really interesting, because it is a circuitry in a sense. You just got to bypass the broken highways. And so I think that's, and in all honesty, the broken area is a minimal area, but because it's right in the middle of a highway, it leads to significant issues below that level of injury. But there's actually nothing wrong with any of the systems below the level of injury. It's just the diminished signals that are going up and down. So, you know, it is my hope and my aim in the future for spinal cord injury research to, you know, once the spinal cord injury occurs, to try and find a way to bypass that so that the issues that occur, you know, months to years down the track don't happen, and you can maintain muscle size and muscle mass and muscle usage and be able to maintain sensation and not have sensory loss and so forth. I mean, you're doing research at the moment in a number of different groups and areas. Do you want to talk a little bit about your robotics research and the stuff that you're doing there?
Yeah, our research is, like you said, I think there is a lot of exciting bits of research happening, some major projects actually with stem cells and other areas. So my primary project at the moment is using EEG-driven rehabilitation with drug therapy and sensory feedback as well. And that's really a combination of some studies that have, animal studies that have come out of Switzerland and some human studies that have come out of the US, which have shown recovery in spinal cord injury using these therapies. I think, I guess without going into too much detail, some of the key points that are important is that drug therapy with particular types of drug potentially increase the excitability of the cord and its amenability for neuroplasticity. And having a top-down and a bottom-up stimulation helps. The important thing to remember is, going back, we said that the spinal cord injuries are rarely anatomically complete. Even if they're clinically complete, where there's no sensory motor function below, it's still likely that there's some fibers left. And I think that's probably an important thing.
I think it's very
important. In the animals, in the animal studies, they showed that there were new interneurons growing in those injury sites with these therapies. So there is probably something happening. We need to do a lot more work to understand it better. But it's an ongoing area that's really interesting. Presumably, you know, humans learn to walk, learn to do things, learn to do that. And we previously thought that spinal cord injury or the spinal cord and the brain is not amenable to repair and change, but perhaps under the right stimuli, that may not be the case.
Yeah, I think this is a good segue to talk briefly about the regenerative capacity of the central nervous system versus the peripheral nervous system. So for people who are listening, the central nervous system is obviously the brain and brain stem, and the peripheral nervous system are all the other nerves that shoot out and away. There is a difference in regeneration, because you can cut your finger and even cut the nerve of your finger, lose sensation of a particular dermatome, yet you can regain that sensation over time as that peripheral nerve regenerates. We know that the spinal cord probably has lesser degree of regeneration, but not absence or lack of regeneration. Matt, do you want to talk a little bit more about the regenerative capacity between the CNS, the central nervous system, and the peripheral nervous system?
Well, the main big difference between the central nervous system in this case being the spinal cord and a peripheral nerve, let's just say like a median nerve, this is commonly impacted in a condition, let's say like carpal tunnel, where you might have the nerve crushed with the tendons going down into your fingers. So the big difference is the peripheral nerves have a different myelinating cell. This is a cell that puts the insulation around the axons, which speed up the transmission of the electrical activity. So in the peripheral nerves, we have a glial cell or a myelinating cell called a Schwann cell, whereas in the spinal cord, it's a oligodendrocyte. And so the main difference is when it's injured, what the spinal cord does, these oligodendrocytes really don't do much at all. Probably a lot of them around the injury site will just die off. But as Mike said, it's almost like a car accident on that freeway. And with a car accident, you have a lot of debris, you know, bits of the car everywhere. Same thing with a spinal cord injury. There's a lot of debris everywhere, but there's nothing to clean it up. So that kind of hampers the repair mechanism. Where in the peripheral nervous system, if you were to have a damage to a peripheral nerve, let's just say it was cut, not crushed, what the Schwann cells do, these are the myelinating cells, they actually detach off the damaged axon and they actually turn onto a different type of cell. They go from a myelinating cell into now a eating cell. So they'll actually start to eat up all that debris. And then another thing that they can do, which is quite remarkable, is they can whistle to the blood immune cells to bring in a macrophage, which is a type of cell that does a lot of eating. It's like a Pac-Man. So it will whistle, they will come out of the blood, come to the injury site and clean up all that debris.
So this is the peripheral nerve.
This is the peripheral nerve. And so this is highly effective. So as soon as you have all that cleaned up, what the axons that have been damaged can do is re-sprout and then find where they need to go distally or downstream to then go to the area where they should go. And as soon as they do that, what the Schwann cells do, and this is the myelinating cell, they turn back into their old form and become myelinated again. So they're remarkable in that sense.
So this doesn't happen in the central nervous
system? It doesn't happen in the central nervous system. But what we're doing in our lab, and Dinesh is part of this, is we are getting these cells from different parts of the body. So there is a group of cells in the nose called olfactory and sheathal cells, which are a bit different to Schwann cells, but they come down, they're kind of like cousins. They're very similar in related. They do a bit different. They kind of do peripheral nerves in the nose, whereas the Schwann cells do all the other peripheral nerves. But we get in these cells and we're going to put them into spinal cord injuries, and hopefully they can do the cleanup better than the oligodendrocytes, and then hopefully we can get some better outcomes in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
One final thing I just wanted to ask you, Dinesh. So you spoke about clinical grading and then anatomical difference, and how what's stated from the clinician is this is the type of damage you got, this is kind of the recovery you're going to have for the rest of your life, but anatomically this could be different. So how do you, what is the grading mechanism? So how does a physician grade a spinal cord injury? Can you just quickly run through that?
Yeah. The most commonly used scale is the ASIA impairment scale. That is the American Spinal Injury Association scale. That has a rating from ASIA A to B.
Okay.
Essentially, this looks at, ASIA A to E, that is. And essentially, that looks at sensory and motor function. ASIA A is a complete injury clinically, right? There's no motor or sensory function below the level of the injury.
Okay.
ASIA B has some sensory function, but no motor function. And that's at the sacral segments of S4 and S5. So your booty should have some sensation.
Okay.
And I'm ASIA B. I started to feel my butt a few weeks after the injury, which is a momentous occasion.
Absolutely. So, but you can't let anybody else feel your butt.
Well,
well, depends on the person.
Depends on the person. To actually get the ASIA scale done, someone has to feel your butt.
Oh, that's a good point. So, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Are you going to ask me to do the next ASIA evaluation?
Well, I know we've been doing it for fun, but let's do it for the skill.
We've been getting the practice in.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, sorry for interrupting. Keep going.
No, so then Asia C is you have some motor function, but it's not great, and it should be more than half of the key muscles below the injury level should have some motor function. And then Asia D is where you have better motor function and your joints can move against gravity.
Oh, yeah.
And then Asia E is just normal. So that's what you guys are.
Okay. So, Dinesh, when you were first graded after your injury, I mean, first of all, how long after your injury did they give you a grade in? Is it like within days or is it?
Honestly, I can't remember.
Okay.
But I was given an initial grading and I was given a grading near discharge and they were different. So initially I was Asia A,
yeah,
and then later I was Asia B.
So, and do you know what you would be? Functions. What would you be now? Still B?
Well, we did one recently actually and it was still B.
Okay.
Okay. And so when we look at, so that's the grading. Now, I think you alluded to it before or spoke about it before, that it's probably rare to have an individual with a fully transected or fully separated spinal cord. Is that correct? Like anatomically, they may be classified as a full transection, but anatomically, things are remaining. And this is the substrate that would probably say for regeneration, this is sort of like the seeds that are remaining that may allow for potential regeneration to occur or even maintain some degree of sensory or motor function. Is that correct?
Exactly. But there's not a huge amount of literature on this, but the understanding at the moment in the literature that is there is that most injuries have some anatomic remains, even though they may not be clinically evident.
Yes, yes, that's right. And I think this is something that you know, the more people with spinal cord injury that I speak to, the more anecdote I get, you know, and the plural of anecdote isn't data, but it is really important. I always talk to people who have experienced a spinal cord injury and they've said to me so often, oh, yeah, I was told that it's complete. I'm not going to be able to do X, Y, and Z. And then, you know, you talk to them and they said, but after 2 years, I was able to do this. Or after 3 months, I was able to do this. And so there is something left. It's either there are highways that are left or there's a regenerative capacity present in some degree or regard that can be enforced or emphasized or supported or even just maintained through maybe physical activity or physical therapy or whatever it may be. And I think that's an important point. And you were alluding to plasticity earlier and that, you know, there's been this dogma within science or medicine that, you know, the brain and the spinal cord, they can't change. Whatever is there and it will not change. And whatever you lose, you've lost forever. But we know, at least we know for the brain, for example, that it is plastic, meaning it can change. And we see it all the time. We see individuals who have had limbs amputated, for example, for whatever reason. We know that the part of their brain, let's just say somebody's had their right arm amputated, the part of their brain dedicated to sensation of that right arm is still intact. So what ends up happening is that part of the brain becomes quite starved for sensory information. That arm's no longer there, so they're not receiving any information. So that part of the brain starts to talk to surrounding areas, and the areas that are close to the arm are actually parts that are mapped to the face. So they start to speak to the areas of the face. And so you can touch somebody's face who's had an arm amputated, not in all cases, but in some cases, they've noted that you can touch their face and say, oh, it feels like you're touching my arm that's no longer there. And that's simply due to plasticity, neurons branching out and having conversations with their neighbors. And this is actually happening in the spinal cord as well. In spinal cord injury, you can have neurons that are remaining and start to have conversations with other remaining neurons. And this can actually change the degree of functionality. It may be sensation, it may be motor. It may not change it, but there is some degree of plasticity that is occurring.
Yeah, and I think we know that for the first couple of years at least, or even longer, that there are spontaneous changes that can happen in people's function. So that has been seen.
Absolutely. Now, I think we should probably leave it there. We could talk about this all day. Dinesh, thank you.
Any final words?
Yeah, any final words?
I guess a couple of other quick things that I think I need to mention is that, you know, spinal cord injury, we talked about all these different things that happen. What you see is the mobility issue outside. You see a person in a wheelchair or whatever, but things go a lot deeper than that. And we touched on some of the things that happen. But spinal cord injury is a very complex situation that affects so many different things. And we touched on things like autonomic dysreflexia, but and we touched on the risks of respiratory diseases like COVID, but you also get things like pressure injury, skin breakdown, which is the incident I had with the delicious pizza recently. it was totally worth it. You get more urinary tract infections, your blood pressure's unstable. And certainly in the initial stages, you're at more risk of DVTs and pulmonary emboli. Mm. So there's a whole heap of issues that happen. And that's not to mention the socioeconomic reasons.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
So it's a really complex disease. And I think wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whether you're a member of the general public, you're a non-medical person, you're a medical person, you're a person in health, in addition to understanding the physiological consequences, I think it's important to realize that it's a very deep thing that affects people in so many ways.
Yes, you've got the scene disability or the surface disability, but there's also a lot that's happening underneath or below that surface and the unseen disability. And you're right, people need to be aware, and I think education is only a good thing. And whether it's people who have a spinal cord injury, it could be carers, it could just be anybody else. I think everybody should be aware of some of the important points surrounding spinal cord injury. So really appreciate your perspective. It is such an important perspective to have the medical perspective and the individual personal life experience perspective and mesh them together. Absolutely invaluable, and I think that this podcast episode is going to be very helpful for many people. So thank you again for joining us, Dinesh.
Thanks, guys. Always love hanging out with the both of you.
I know. I wish you were in this, I was going to say studio, but it's just Matt's office.
It's close enough to a studio.
You need to be in for the next episode. You need to be sitting here with us to do the next episode.
I was planning to come, but I was waiting for a new bed to be delivered, which actually got delivered as we were speaking.
Oh, so nice. Well, how's that?
It was lucky.
Was that all the noise in the background?
No, we're very good at that. Very, 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 very sneaky.
Well, look, thank you. And hopefully next time we speak to you, you've either won another award or you've decided to be a plumber or something. I don't know. You're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're a legend. You're a what do we say, a sea captain as well. So I mean,
yeah. Was there something else that we were talking about?
No, I don't think there was. I don't think there was.
Are you sure?
Thank you, Dinesh.
All right, thanks, boys.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.